where we left off was with the abandonment, frankly, of American culture to liberal Protestant theology. And we see this, you know, we've got the world wars and things like that that are affecting this, and there are a number of other things that, movements that occurred during the period that would be worth talking about if we were on a different subject. But let's just take it up to the 1950s. I know a lot of conservatives that look at the 1950s as almost a golden age in America, you know, where we, you know, we had a good functioning society, most people were in churches and all of this kind of thing. And what I would tell you is that the 1950s, if it were a golden age, it was a golden age of liberal Protestantism. Because it had the mainline churches, which were the dominant churches across the country, had all basically adopted liberal theology, social gospel kinds of things, and so on. And the people who wanted to believe that the Bible was inerrant, those kinds of things, people who talked about the importance of conversion, they were those fundamentalist backwood hicks, the holy rollers, the, you know, fill in the blank, whatever term you want to use. They were not part of mainstream American society. And that was by their own choice. Now, that began to change, actually, though, really in the late 1940s. There are three key people that I would point to that I would argue are really important transitional figures that are going to help transform fundamentalism into something really very different and, in general, much, much more positive. The first of them is Carl F. H. Henry. Carl Henry wrote a book in 1947 called The Uneasy Conscience of Modern Fundamentalism. And the basic point in the book was that the anti-intellectualism of the fundamentalists was completely misguided. It was out of place. It was something that should never have happened. And that the fundamentalism needed to get serious about the life of the mind. It needed to get serious about thinking about theology. It needed to get serious about apologetics. It needed to get serious about coming up with a rational explanation of their theology. Because, well, Jesus says the greatest commandment is love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. He is paraphrasing slightly the Old Testament. The Old Testament says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength. Jesus said, heart, soul, mind, and strength. He added mind. How do you love God with your mind if you're following this totally anti-intellectual kind of approach that most fundamentalists were doing? It was, in fact, a religion that was not only privatized, but it was really, in many ways, closer to what early liberals were saying about religion being about emotional experience and things like that. It was really much closer to that than it was to historic Christianity. And Henry started calling the fundamentalists out on that. He'll be one of the founders of Fuller Theological Seminary, also in 1947. He'll be one of the founders of the Evangelical Theological Society, 1949. And together with our second figure, he's going to be the founding editor of Christianity Today in 1956. So Henry is putting a huge amount of emphasis on the importance of getting back in the game in terms of theology and intellectual life. The second figure, of course, is Billy Graham. He's the one who actually founded Christianity Today in 56 and brought on Henry as the editor. Now, Graham was really unique. There were a lot of revivalist-type preachers around, but Billy Graham was really different. He was young, he was good-looking, he was funny. Actually, go on YouTube and look up Woody Allen and Billy Graham. Woody Allen actually had Billy Graham on a talk show that he had, and Billy Graham held his own with Woody Allen. I mean, he was incredibly charismatic, And he made this sort of crusade revival type preaching. He made it something that people thought, but yeah, this is kind of interesting. And people started paying attention to him because of that. And his popularity is actually going to raise the profile of fundamentalism. But he doesn't stay in the fundamentalist camp, because in 1957, he held a crusade in New York. And this crusade was groundbreaking in a couple of ways. First of all, it was integrated. He had black ministers on the platform with white ministers. Graham had no patience at all for segregation. So he's taking a stand here. Prior to the real civil rights movement getting kicking off, he's actually already moving in that direction. But the other thing he did is he had a policy that any minister who wanted to support the crusade was welcome to sit on the platform with him. And a bunch, because Graham is popular, a bunch of liberal pastors in New York said, "Hey, Billy, we'll support you." And he said, "Come on up." He invited him to stay on the platform. At this point, the fundamentalists lost their minds. They said, "Billy, you can't do this." And he said, "Why not?" He said, "Well, because they're liberals. You're going to compromise the faith." He says, no, wait a minute. I'm going to preach exactly the way I preached every other place. I'm not going to change a word of what I would be saying just because these guys are on the platform. And further, the fact that they are on the platform means that their congregations and their people are going to hear the gospel. The fundamentalists said, no. Scripture says you can't be tainted by the world. You've got to kick them off the platform. He said, "I'm not being tainted by the world. The world isn't tainting anything that I'm doing." The response on the fundamentalist side was, "You can't be tainted by people who are tainted by the world." It's called second degree separation. You can't be tainted by people who are tainted by the world. And Billy Graham said, "I'm sorry, they're staying." And the net result is at this point we get a split developing between the fundamentalists, who at this point are now focused on this issue of second degree separation, and what becomes known as the evangelicals. The evangelicals who are much more open to interacting with liberals, not compromising what they're saying, but allowing them up on the platform, talking to them, getting engaged with the world again. This is what Henry was pointing toward, particularly in the intellectual life. This is what Graham is really going to, in a lot of ways, pioneer. And at this point, like I said, we get the split between the fundamentalists, who still want to stay isolated, and the evangelicals, who are taking that historic type Christian doctrine and trying to advance it into the culture again. That brings us to our third key figure, Francis Schaeffer. Francis Schaeffer is not, he was an evangelist, but a very different kind of evangelist than Billy Graham was. If I were going to try to define Schaeffer with one word, I would say he was an evangelist. But he's an evangelist of a very unusual kind. He moved to Switzerland as a missionary, and in 1948, he established a retreat center, I don't know what to call it exactly, called L'Abri. It's French for the shelter. And he invited anybody, he always prayed, by the way, that God would send to him the people that he wanted there, and he would keep away anyone God didn't want there. Okay. It was a place for people, young people typically, with questions, philosophically minded, whatever, where they could come and talk about their questions. And Schaeffer would interact with them on this basis. He was really good at asking questions. He understood where the worldviews of these different people who were coming in, where their weaknesses were, where they were unlivable. And he could ask good questions to lead people to see the inadequacy of the way they were looking at the world. And this would then open them up to consider other options, notably Christianity. So it's a very unusual kind of evangelism, but that's what he did. And he developed what he called middle way apologetics. You know, you have the two main schools of apologetics that were popular in this period were presuppositionalism, mostly held by Reformed guys, especially the Dutch, that said that everything is really based on the presuppositions you have, and until the Holy Spirit actually moves somebody so that they can see the problems with their presupposition, there's really no point in even discussing with them, frankly. You know, because there's no way they can understand. The carnal person cannot understand the things of the Spirit because they're spiritually discerned. You know, that's their key verse. So you've got presuppositionalism on the one hand, you have evidentialism on the other, where you give evidences for the truthfulness of the gospel, the resurrection of Christ, those kinds of things. Schaeffer combined the two. He said there are elements of both of them that are valid, and both of them can be used in appropriate ways to bring people to the Lord. So he comes up with this third way approach. Now, by the way, there's a fourth way that he didn't talk about, which is classical apologetics, different subject. But the key thing, the most important thing about Schaeffer in terms of his impact is the work he did at Libri inspired an entire generation of evangelical scholars. People like Oz Guinness, on the one hand, toward the beginning of this, and me at the tail end. I moved into academia, partly because I don't think I could have done anything else. I'm not really competent at anything else. But also because of the inspiration of Francis Schaeffer. So there's a, and you know, Oz, like I said, is an early one. I'm a late one, but there's a whole host of others in between that were inspired by Schaeffer's work. Monumentally important. Two of his late works, you know, he dies in 1984, two of his last works are A Christian Manifesto, which I believe we have on the table there, in which he is arguing for the importance of Christians to get involved, particularly in life issues, abortion, notably, some others as well. But then in 1984, he wrote a very surprisingly early book called The Great Evangelical Disaster, in which he said, that's also over there, in which he said that evangelicalism is in danger of losing truth. It is seriously in danger of losing its grasp of biblical truth. He was right. And we'll talk tomorrow morning about that dynamic. But Schaeffer already saw this in 84, way before anybody else was really talking about it. Well, along with these three figures that really have a revolutionary effect on evangelicalism, we also have something else that occurs in the late 60s and especially in the 70s. It's known as the Jesus Movement. Now, this is something that most people who talk about church history ignore, but if you're talking about American evangelicalism, you can't. It's going to begin at a church called Calvary Chapel, pastored by Chuck Smith. It's going to be the key place where a lot of this is going to take off. And this is the period in which you have, you know, the hippies and the counterculture and all of that. Well, the Jesus Movement is when the counterculture discovers the gospel. Like I said, starts Chuck Smith, Calvary Chapel, big across California, spreads to other parts of the country as well. You see a guy named Larry Norman emerging. Larry Norman was a sort of an old school rock and roller who invented what was then called Jesus music. First person to really do this kind of thing and inspired a host of others. This is really the beginning of what we call contemporary Christian music, although it wasn't big business then. And it wasn't its own little counterculture. We'll talk about that tomorrow. What you see within the Jesus Movement that is going to color evangelicalism from then on is, first of all, the music. But then along with this, there's a tremendous emphasis within the Jesus Movement on evangelism. That's what these guys were all about, was evangelism. There is also a very strong emphasis on experience, on conversion and on emotional experiences. We're back to Schleiermacher a bit here. That is going to color the way evangelicalism operates from this point on. And they are also going to buy into wholeheartedly the entire dispensational theological system. And that is also going to cement its place as within the mainstream of evangelicalism. Okay, so the Jesus movement is going to, you know, from a bunch of hippies that were really countercultural, it's going to really shape mainstream evangelical culture in some pretty profound ways. Net results, some of the results of these movements, we could talk about the charismatic movement as well, but some other things. Evangelicalism really replaces fundamentalism. Fundamentalism doesn't go away, but it is increasingly isolated. The theology formerly known as fundamentalist makes its way into the cultures through evangelicalism. You're seeing intellectual engagement. You're seeing people who are culturally active. You see people who are beginning to get politically involved as well. None of that was true of the fundamentalists. Fundamentalism does remain viable for a time as its own sort of little enclave subculture within America, but eventually that dissolves. It gets absorbed into evangelicalism. There's still remnants of old-line fundamentalism around, but they're very small. Ultimately, evangelicalism will absorb the fundamentalists. Now, the fact that evangelicalism is now, you know, Billy Graham is popular, you know, he's well known. You know, you've got people engaging in universities, things like that. You've got, on a pop culture level, you've got the Jesus movement, all of these kinds of things. Raise the profile of evangelicalism up to the point where an evangelical gets elected president. Jimmy Carter, self-proclaimed, self-defined evangelical, still teaches, last I heard, he's still teaching a Sunday school class at his Baptist church. He's elected president. Time magazine declares 1976, the year Carter is elected president, the year of the evangelical. Evangelicalism's arrived. It's mainstream now. Now, of course, a lot of evangelicals weren't really thrilled with Carter. Actually, the fact that he was a one-term president indicates that a lot of people weren't thrilled with Carter. But the evangelicals in particular objected to a lot of the directions Carter's policy was taking. And so a guy who didn't call himself an evangelical for a very long time, still called himself a fundamentalist, by the name of Jerry Falwell, emerges. And in 1979, he hits the big time, starting an organization called the Moral Majority. And at this point, the thing that's notable about Carter is Carter didn't run as an evangelical, he ran as a Democrat. He was an evangelical who ran as a Democrat. Okay. The connection between his faith and what he's doing wasn't really obvious, and he didn't really push that point. Falwell says that we need to bring Christianity into politics, and we need to do this explicitly. He's particularly concerned about abortion and the emerging gay movement, the LGBTQ stuff, as we would call it today. That's it. Those are his main issues. And he wants to push these things into the forefront of political discussion. Now, he's still calling himself a fundamentalist, but this is not a fundamentalist move. This is evangelicalism. And eventually Falwell, I think, will adopt that title. And certainly Liberty University now describes itself not as a fundamentalist school, but an evangelical school. But in any event, Falwell is going to basically set up an alliance with the Republican Party. The Republican Party is going to adopt many of the policies on its platform that Falwell is going to advocate. The success of this program is going to show up in 1980 when Ronald Reagan is elected president. Now, the irony here is that looking at Reagan's biography to this point, there is nothing that would indicate an evangelical commitment. And yet the evangelicals are going to back him in the election to unseat the self-defined evangelical Carter. So there are some rather interesting dynamics that are going on here. Reagan's genius, and it was genius, was he united two groups that up to this point had never really played well together. Fiscal conservatives and social conservatives. In a weird way, these two had never really merged together. They were both operating, they had their own issues, their own things that they were focused on, and neither of them was particularly interested in the other side. What Reagan does is he manages to set up a way that unites these two groups. And that creates, in a lot of ways, the modern conservative movement, backed by evangelicals, because the social conservative component of this matches with evangelical values, traditional values, family values, anti-LGBT stuff, you know, all of those kinds of things, and anti-abortion. So at this point, what you see is this is the time at which the Republican Party and the evangelicals begin to identify with each other. It happens here. With Reagan's election, with his re-election, and you know, people called him the Teflon president, and the reason is nothing would stick to him. You could attack him any way you wanted to, and none of it would stick. I remember one point where I don't even remember what the detail was. And part of this was Reagan's own persona. He just came across as a genuinely unassuming kind of guy. So at one point, he said something, and a reporter tried to do a gotcha on him, and because he'd gotten the fact wrong. And he looked at the reporter and said, "Okay, I forgot that detail. I'm sorry, it happens." And he just went on. So Reagan's immense popularity and the fact that the evangelicals had hitched their wagon to the Republicans and Reagan, suddenly evangelicals had unprecedented cultural influence. And you started having people all over. I mean, I heard one guy, when the Red Sox actually made it into the playoffs one year, one guy said, "Yeah, I'm a born-again Red Sox fan." What does that mean? but the language, this is an indication of the degree to which evangelical language has now permeated the culture. And suddenly, evangelicalism is kind of in. Well, thank you. Okay, so this is evangelicalism in terms of politics and things like that. Let's look at another thing that's going on at roughly the same time. That guy there's name is Donald McGavran. McGavran was a missiologist, a guy who specializes in studying missionaries. And McGavran was really familiar with the situation in India, and there was something that perplexed him. There were certain places where the gospel spread really quickly in India and other places where it just fizzled. And he really wanted to understand why. And after studying the thing and applying a sociological analysis to the situation, what McGavran concluded in his book, Bridges of God, what he concluded was that the gospel spreads best when the people who are spreading it are in the culture or in a closely related culture. In other words, if you can find someone within a particular tribe in India, let's say, who comes to faith, or someone in a tribe that's culturally close to that tribe, find them to come to faith, they will be a much more effective evangelist than a missionary from America will. The gospel spreads best and easiest among people who are culturally similar to each other. The bigger the gap, the harder it is for evangelism to take off. Makes good sense. Okay, so that's Bridges of God. The idea here then is what you want to do is If you can get one person, work through them, have them do the work to penetrate the culture. Okay, strategy that's still being used in missions today. He eventually became the head of the School of World Missions at Fuller Theological Seminary. Now, what's this got to do with the church growth movement? Well, the church growth movement takes McGavran's work and tries to apply it to the United States. Rather than thinking in terms of tribal groups or cultural groups, what they say is, well, effectively, a particular demographic group has its own kind of culture. And so what we should do, if we want the gospel to spread the quickest, what we should do is aim it at a specific, set up our churches that are designed to target a specific demographic group. Typically, this is upper middle class whites. The next step is you want to, you know, as part of targeting this group, you want to understand what the group likes, what they're interested in, so on. And so you want to make the church comfortable for them. You want them to have it feel familiar. You want to select music for the services that will reach that particular demographic group. And you want the as you're trying to address that group, you want to talk about their felt needs. That is the foundation of the church growth movement. Now, what happens along with this is you begin picking up a corporate model of the church where the pastor is effectively the CEO and so on. But you know what? It works to build big churches. You begin getting the arrival and growth of mega churches. A mega church defined as having 2,000 attendees on a typical Sunday. Now, I would argue, on a theological level, there are multiple things wrong with this. One of them is that a pastor is not a CEO. They're different. But I would argue at an even more fundamental level, this is a complete misapplication of McGavran. That, in fact, this is a denial of one of the things that Jesus and Paul talk about the most about the gospel. And that's that it breaks down barriers between people. If you're targeting a specific demographic, you are building walls between people. You are not breaking them down. The gospel is the only thing in the world, the only thing in human history that has the potential and has proven to have the potential to unite people who are otherwise at odds with each other. Jesus talks about this in his farewell discourse, the last teaching, the thing that he wanted his disciples to understand and have in mind as he was going to his death was the importance of unity. The Apostle Paul talks about there's no Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, we're all one in Christ. This is, I would argue, fundamentally, theologically, a horribly flawed model. The irony, though, to take it a step further, is you do get these megachurches, but you also, as a result, begin developing Christian subcultures. So that, yeah, you can have all of your friends in the church. You can have all of your entertainment in the church. Jesus music now turns into contemporary Christian music and it becomes sort of a big deal. It creates an entire Christian subculture so that you don't actually have to interact with your lost neighbors at all. Maybe the people you work with, but that's about it. So rather than being an outreach-oriented model, by creating these Christian subcultures, it actually kills outreach. And the huge irony is that McGavran's whole point was you can't go into a foreign country and set up a mission station and hope that people are going to come to it to get saved. You have to be out in the culture. This is a mission station model. The megachurch is a mission station. It's a, yeah, we'll invite you to come in and join us and see if you like it. It's not about going out into the community. So it's a complete, like I said, when I say that this is a misapplication of McGavran, that's an understatement. Okay. But this becomes, our metrics for a church's success are the ABCs: attendance, buildings, and cash. I've heard people describe it as the three Bs: buildings, budgets, and butts. Those aren't the gospel's metrics, but those are the ones we use. Where do we get those metrics from? Well, if the pastor is a CEO, why not use business models to understand what a successful church looks like? And because, well, face it, every pastor wants to have a big church. It's natural. It's perfectly understandable, and it's actually a laudable ambition as long as you do it right. The megachurch becomes the model then for other churches to follow. You get the Willow Creek Association. You get all kinds of things like that where people are going to the megachurches to learn what they did. And this then becomes increasingly the norm within evangelicalism, even among churches that don't rise to the level of a megachurch. All of this is fine until the cultural pendulum swings. About every 20 years, we get a shift in the political winds and cultural winds in the country. And so, not surprisingly, in the 2000s, we see a shift away from Reagan-style conservatism or Bush-style neoconservatism. We start seeing a growing emphasis on multiculturalism. We elect Barack Obama as president. We see increasingly the mainstreaming of I've been using the longer acronym. You'll notice earlier, if you look at the slides, I've talked about LGB and LGBT. Now we're getting LGBTQ+. We're getting more and more things piling on. That's becoming increasingly mainstreamed. The biggest influence on this, by the way, is a TV show called Will and Grace. But eventually, President Obama runs in his first term on opposing same-sex marriage. After he's elected for the second term, he comes out in favor of it. And although every election where there's a referendum on it, it loses, the courts impose it, and the people just kind of acquiesce. Critical theory emerges. It's been there for those of you who heard me last year and will know it's been around for a while by this point, but at this point it's beginning to emerge into broader American culture. And of course it'll explode under Trump with the Black Lives Matter riots and things like that. The churches under these circumstances are left scrambling. They were in a position where they had a certain amount of cultural influence, cultural cachet, and that kind of thing. They were broadly accepted back when the country was in a conservative phase. But now that the country was moving out of this conservative phase, the churches aren't entirely sure what to do. They're used to being popular. They're used to having influence. They're used to people listening to them. They're used to helping shape public opinion. And suddenly they're not anymore. What do you do then? Well, a lot of them work to retool themselves in order to become relevant. Relevant meaning addressing the issues that the society is bringing forward. Many of them decide that the best thing that they can do is to become missional, aimed at the urban elites that are really driving these cultural changes. We can see this with someone like Redeemer Presbyterian Church and Tim Keller. You know, he argues that being in the city and reaching people in the city is critical. And so they start working on becoming missional to these groups that are moving the culture further and further to the left. And frankly, they're really working to maintain some degree of cultural approval. The problem with this, This is where we run into the situation we're in now. The problem with this is, first of all, there's nothing less relevant than a church that tries to be relevant. If you are trying to be relevant, you are allowing the culture to dictate the terms. They dictate the agenda. Scripture doesn't. The only way the church can be relevant is if the church stands for eternal truths. It needs to take these eternal truths and apply them to the situation that they're in. It needs to apply these truths to the culture. What it cannot do is follow the culture's lead. If it does this, it's always going to be two steps behind, maybe three. You know, I know somebody who argues that you know when something is passing out of popular culture when the church adopts it. The additional problem is that congregations, and this has probably been a problem for years, but it's been made worse by the megachurch phenomenon, congregations are frankly poorly catechized. They do not know the faith. And more importantly, well, as important as not knowing the faith, they don't know why the faith. This isn't just a matter of apologetics. Now, my evidence for this that I would point to is the, I think it was called the Reveal study that was done by Willow Creek, in which they determined that with all of their programs and everything else, they were doing nothing to help their people grow in their Christian maturity. How do you actually disciple 2,000 people on a Sunday? How do you do that? You can't. The effect of this, you know, as just an example, when we are teaching sexual morality, it is frequently given as a series of rules, mostly starting with the word don't. Okay. All of those rules are good. They're all scripturally appropriate. We rarely talk about the do, what sexuality is. We don't really think through why sexuality even exists, what it's for, what God's purpose. God, you know, sex was God's idea. We never really talk about what that idea is. What is the function of sex? You know who did this the best? A celibate Catholic theologian by the name of Thomas Aquinas. He has the best analysis of what sexuality is about that I've ever seen. But we never talk about the positive, what it's for, what it's about, and we never explain why the don'ts are there. If you don't understand the do's, you'll never understand the don'ts. And if you don't understand the entire context, well, what happens when your high school student goes off to University of Montana? What happens when your high school student who really is, you know, was active in the youth group in the church and all of that kind of thing, goes off to college and gets challenged on his sexual or her sexual views? If they don't understand the why, they are sitting ducks. And the net result, well, the statistics. 78 to 80% of high school graduates coming out of evangelical schools leave the church. Now, this isn't a new phenomenon. When people go off to college, frequently they stop attending church. Usually, they come back when they get out of college, and particularly when they start families. Unfortunately, they're not coming back. Only 35% actually return. Historically, this is unprecedented. This has never happened before. Okay, well, maybe when they get married and start having kids, they'll return. Marriage isn't happening. The marriage rates are plummeting. And even within marriage, childbirth rates are plummeting. People are getting married and just not wanting children. Because, of course, we don't explain what marriage and children are for. Okay. So the net result is the entire approach we're using to disciple the next generation of Christians is failing. We've adopted a failure model. Rather than playing games in youth group, it's probably a much better idea to prepare them for what's going to happen when they get to college. Because otherwise, the university will eat their lunch. Well, of course, we aren't in the Obama years anymore. Politics has changed substantially, courtesy of this gentleman, Donald Trump. Now, Trump is a difficult person to assess in many ways. Did you know, for example, that for a long time, evangelicals argued that moral character was the main criteria you needed in a leader? Under those circumstances, Jimmy Carter wins hands down. Donald Trump is, let's just say he's got a problematic past. Okay? Now, some of this has been exaggerated and things like that. That's there. But he is not the kind of person evangelicals would have lined up behind before. And yet, when you look at reactions to Trump within the evangelical world, they actually parallel the broader culture as well. There are three categories of people out there. You've got your never-Trumpers who want nothing to do with him. Absolutely no. Okay. You have your ardent pro-Trump people. These are the people who they don't really think he walks on water, but they can get pretty close to it. And then you have your third group, which I suspect, and this might be wishful thinking, but I suspect is the largest group. And this is your pragmatic pro-Trump people, among the people who support Trump. Your pragmatic pro-Trump people are, I suspect, the largest group. These are the people who recognize Trump's liabilities, who recognize that the guy can be a jerk sometimes. But when you look at his policies are going in the right direction. And so while you might not necessarily like the guy personally, or you might think he's got moral issues that would normally disqualify someone for consideration by a Christian, his policies are going in the right direction. And when you look at all the alternatives, who else? Hillary? But Trump is a polarizing figure. Along with Trump, during the Trump administration, you also see the emergence of Black Lives Matter. It's been around longer, but this is when it really becomes public with George Floyd. You start seeing riots. You start seeing Antifa out and all of that kind of thing. By the way, have you noticed that these have essentially completely disappeared under Biden? Despite the fact that you can't make any credible argument that there's been a substantial change in racism or whatever in America, that should tell you a few things. I talked about critical race theory and critical theory and stuff last year. I'm not going to go into that, but that is now emerging as a major force, or under Trump, it emerged as a force culturally. And then also under Trump, you have the arrival of COVID. And also under Trump, you start getting lockdowns. And this generates controversy. But all of these things generate controversy within the church. You've got your pro and anti-Trump stuff within the church. You've got BLM and CRT and anti-BLM and CRT in the church. You also have anti and pro mask and lockdown in the church. And in a lot of ways, I think COVID ends up being probably the most important of these issues because it raises, in the most pointed way, the critical question. What is the legitimate extent of governmental power? And how should we as Christians think about that? But all of these, like I said, end up being fracture points within individual churches and within evangelicalism in general. So where are we left with? Here's as our next set of paradoxes and problems. First of all, the alliance with Republicans. This worked for some values of the word work while we were in a conservative phase. In other words, while we were in a conservative phase, working together with the Republicans, while the Republicans were in power, gave evangelicals a degree of cultural cachet and influence that they no longer have. Worked is what, when I use the word worked there, that's what I mean. This extent of cultural acceptability and so on. Unfortunately, cultural power has swung to the left, particularly among the elites. And what we see happening in America today is a split between elites and populists. It's a bit oversimplified, but for present purposes, that will work. The same split exists within the evangelical church. The net result is we have a division that takes place. Evangelicals that want to be relevant tend to shift left and tend to shift toward critical theory. They want to be missional to the elites, and this is where the elites are, and so this is where they go. Republican evangelicals stay conservative. They stay to the right. They represent, in a lot of ways, the vox populi, the voice of the people. They're aimed much more toward populism, whereas the ones going left are aimed much more at current elite culture. What this means is that both halves of the evangelical divide are politicized, and thus evangelicalism has become polarized. And the net result is, because of politics, at least on the surface because of politics, evangelicalism is in danger of imploding. The evangelical movement, if trajectories continue the way they are now, we can say effectively evangelicalism is dead. Now, notice, I have to be careful how I said that. On the surface, the issue is political. There are deeper underlying issues behind the politics that are actually worldview issues on a really, really fundamental level. That's what we're going to begin talking about tomorrow. The first talk, again, is going to be on what I see as a de facto worldview within evangelicalism, how it compares to a truly biblical vision of the world, and how it compares to our culture's visions of the world. So that's where we're going to start tomorrow. We're going to pick up on the underlying things that feed into the politicization and the political divide we see there. Now, Dick asked me to speak about a few books here. I'm very familiar with two of the authors. The first one is Why You Think the Way You Do. This is a history of Western civilization from the lens of changing worldview. It starts in the Roman Empire, and it traces the impact of Christianity in shaping Western culture and what the implications are as Christianity loses its influence.
Okay. Buy it before somebody else do. You need it.
Okay. Well, I hate to say this, but a number of the predictions I made in this have in fact come true since I wrote it. My most recent book is Slaying Leviathan. The title might need a little bit of explanation. The book Leviathan was written by a guy named Thomas Hobbes in the 17th century, and it was a defense of absolutism, the idea that the government, and particularly in his case the king, had absolute authority over everything, including religion in the kingdom. Now the fact is, this is a complete violation of biblical teaching about government. And so what I did in this is talk about how Christianity, from day one, has always stood in opposition to totalitarian governments, has always actually developed the entire concept of human rights, and particularly with the Protestant Reformation, has developed a well-thought-out theory of how you resist governments that become tyrannical. So, this is my most recent book, and it deals specifically with those kinds of issues, limited government and resistance. And I've already talked about this one, Francis Schaeffer, The Great Evangelical Disaster. Schaeffer wrote this in 1984, amazingly prescient, describes a lot of what we see in the evangelical world today.